Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode and interview from Reverse Your Heart Disease Naturally Summit. But really, really pay attention, because one of the most common series of questions has been, how do I naturally approach my blood sugar, my blood cholesterol, my blood pressure? I don't want to be on drugs. I want to be on less drugs. You always got to work with your doctor on that. So I brought in a dear friend and a world expert, and let me introduce him, Dr. Joseph Lamb, MD. He's in his office on the West Coast of the United States. He did undergrad at Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, went ahead to internal medicine at Presbyterian University of Pennsylvania Medical Center, one of the premier medical centers, in this case, in Philadelphia. Dr. Lamb is very academic, double board certified in internal medicine and holistic integrative medicine, and is certified in addition by something called the Institute for Functional Medicine. We've known each other for over a decade. I've seen him lecture. I would call him my mentor as I sat through his lectures. But he also has the experience of over 20 years of private practice. So he really deals with patients that have real problems, just like you listening. Co-owner, medical director of the Personalized Lifestyle Medicine Center by Metagenics in Gig Harbor, Washington, the state of Washington. He's been the investigator in over 75 clinical research studies and medical director for Nature's Sunshine Products in Utah. So he brings really that great academic and clinical and industry combination that puts it all together. So Dr. Lamb, Joe, thanks so much for taking your time.
Well, Dr. Khan, that was a very gracious introduction. So thank you. And it's an honor to be here today.
Yeah, you really are a big kahuna, and we're really grateful for being able to have you share with us. So let's just ask a few questions, and I know people will be taking notes and researching a lot of what you say, but what's your approach? I mean, people drop dead of heart disease and had no clue. The family didn't know, the doctor didn't know, the patient didn't know, and they're just dead. And that is actually the single most common presentation of coronary artery disease. We want to do better than that. So what's your approach when you see a patient at your clinic in Gig Harbor to assessing their vascular risk, their vessel risk?
Absolutely. You know, what you're talking about is, you know, that preclinical phase before that event takes place. Because you didn't just wake up that Monday morning and have a heart attack. You got there along the way. And I think one of the really relevant pieces, and where we miss a lot, is in the diagnosis of prediabetes and insulin resistance. And the testing that we do, the standard testing that we do for diabetes, checking a fasting blood sugar, really lets us down in that regard. If you think about the natural progression, the first step is pancreatic dysfunction. The mitochondria in the pancreas are stressed. They oversecrete insulin, whether it's because they've been stressed by too many carbohydrates, too many fats, or whether they've been stressed by all the toxins in our environment. They are, the response is an oversecretion by the islet cells of insulin, and you get a hyperinsulinemia that takes place. And that's the very earliest stages that you see. And that's followed then by blood sugars not being able to be controlled, even despite the higher insulin levels, because of the development of insulin resistance. And then you get blood sugars that are elevated post meals, which we're also not typically assessing. And then finally, fairly late in the progression of this, the first laboratory findings in terms of a fasting blood sugar show up, and a lot has already been going on. And it's kind of one of the tragedies of looking at someone who's, you know, an average American now who's overweight or obese, and saying to them, well, you have a fasting blood sugar that's normal, so you're good. Well, they probably aren't. They're working their way towards that trouble. Because if you calculate it, their HOMA score, which is just insulin times fasting blood sugar divided by 405, you'd have a marker to look at that pre-diabetes.
So you are, sounds like, even though we're early in the conversation, you're going to get a lot of lab work. Somebody shows up at your clinic and says, I don't feel well, and my brother just had bypass at age 54. You're going to get a lot of tubes of blood, I imagine.
We do, but some of those aren't, you know, what we just talked about. You get one tube of blood to get your chemistries. You can do an insulin and a hemoglobin A1C on that same tube. And for things like looking at blood pressure, you know, the 2017 ACC AAHA guidelines for what hypertension is now, you know, we've had a steady progression in terms of lowering the numbers that we consider acceptable for blood pressure. And we now, you know, we went from using terms like borderline to pre-hypertension. And now the category of elevated hypertension is having a systolic between, I'm sorry, elevated blood pressure is having a systolic between 120 to 129. And that's with having your diastolic less than 80. And we're calling that elevated blood pressure. Yeah. So relatively simple things can be done if we're paying attention to the changing standards and we're paying attention to the signs. And, you know, whereas we used to think that we overate, we became overweight or obese and we became diabetic, what we recognize now is disordered physiology leads to us being overweight. So overweight and being obese is actually the sign that those changes are already taking place and we're getting into trouble.
All right. And, you know, for the group listening that may not be familiar, I just want to remind you, use the term islet cells. Those are cells in the pancreas that produce insulin and help maintain a adequate and low blood sugar overall. And HOMA, H-O-M-A, it's not a city in Louisiana, although there is one by that name, but it is a blood test you can get through places like LabCorp, and there's a version at Quest, but you have to be fasting. I've gotten pretty loose in my clinic. If you're here, and sometimes they travel quite a distance, I'm getting your blood work whether you ate or not. But obviously for fasting insulin and to calculate a HOMA score, you're going to have to arrange a patient to have fasting blood work, no doubt about it.
And as a clinician, it's really pretty simple to calculate the HOMA. You don't even need to ask the lab to do it. It's just glucose times insulin divided by 405, and you get a number in the single digits, hopefully, and less than one is probably ideal. Greater than two is moving into the range of insulin resistance, and between one and two is thinking about, you know, what can you be doing better?
How much do you rely on a blood test? A lot of people have heard about a bit in the summit, hemoglobin A1C, as determining where you are in that journey from normal glucose metabolism to very perturbed.
I get that as well. But, you know, hemoglobin A1C is going to be affected when your blood sugar has already started going up. So it's a good way of showing us that progression. Like in the early stage of hyperinsulinemia, a HOMA score will show it to you. In the second stage, where fasting blood sugar is still normal, but your post-meal blood sugars are getting out of control, hemoglobin A1C is going to show that influence. And okay. So, you know, catching it at 5.7 to 6.5 is the pre-diabetic range.
Right. And you brought this up just a moment ago, and I want to clarify something. You know, with 3/4 of Americans, and probably it's true in many other Western countries, they're either overweight or obese. Is obesity the cause of diabetes, hypertension, atherosclerosis?
Now, I think of it more as one of the first signs of the disordered physiology that we see. You know, there are all sorts of things that create oxidative stress in the mitochondria. Barbara Corky, who, like, back in 2011, she's a researcher at Boston University. She won the Banting Award at the American Diabetes Association meeting. And I think it was, it was 2011. And it was on her work of the lack of balance between our oxidative systems and our reductive symptom systems. And she pointed out, for example, that saccharin is a direct mitochondrial toxin in that regard and leads to hyperinsulinemia. She pointed out that iron actually has a negative impact. And, you know, at first when she said that, I was like, yeah, that's probably not a big deal for most people. But then she pointed out something that was very interesting. In our move to low fat, the average American's iron intake has probably gone up. Because if you were eating ground beef, right, that was, you know, 40% fat, it was 60% beef. And if you eat still a pound nowadays and it's 85-15, you're getting a lot more meat and protein and hence a lot more iron.
Yeah, there's a fairly recent research project in congestive heart failure. I think it was an animal model that brought out that iron toxicity may be underestimated. And I've also been taught that with the increase in refined flour, that would be your bagel, your donut, your crackers, your white bread and all, they're often iron fortified refined flours. And we may just be ingesting a mitochondrial toxin that imbalances our zinc and our copper and our antioxidant pathway. Interesting that you bring that up. What do you mean? I remember you lecturing about evaluate function, not disease, and maybe, you know, share that with the audience. I think it's really important.
One of the earliest signs of endothelial dysfunction, like endothelium being the lining of the blood vessel, and if the lining of the blood vessel is healthy, the blood vessel can dilate when appropriate. Like as flow increases, the blood vessel dilates, you get more blood flow. It's the way we direct blood flow to where we need it at different times. After a meal, we direct it to our gut so that we can digest things. If we've gone for a run, we direct our blood flow so we get it going to our muscles. The endothelium, if it's exposed to things like too much insulin, if it's exposed to things like various toxins that come from the gut as a consequence of a leaky gut, like lipopolysaccharide or also called endotoxin, you know, if we're getting some of that in, you know, we get that kind of post-meal double whammy of, you know, sugar, fat, and endotoxin, we get lack of responsiveness to our endothelium. And as a consequence of getting that, we get stiffer blood vessels, and it's the earliest physiologic change in hypertension and in atherosclerosis, because you can get damage to those walls if they don't relax, which triggers the whole atherosclerotic process. But you can actually measure endothelial dysfunction by using various devices. Endopat, which is made by an Israeli company called Itamar, is a wonderful device for looking at endothelial dysfunction and being able to measure it and quantify it and follow it over time. You know, it's basically measuring peripheral artery tone, hence EndoPat. But there are other devices that do that. You know, in the more of the research setting, people use flow-mediated vasodilation and use ultrasound to look at the brachial artery, for example. And that's where some of the studies that show the roles for things is like dark chocolate, the flavonoids in dark chocolate making a role in terms of improving endothelial function.
A lot of people just got happy you mentioned dark chocolate because they've heard a lot about broccoli and Brussels sprouts. Yeah, I have an EndoPat set up in my preventive clinic. We don't use it as much as I did 5 years ago, but I think for a lot of people, they probably have never heard something you just said, but that measurement called arterial stiffness. Can't do it with a stethoscope, can't do it with your eyeball. It's a measurement that requires some kind of machinery, but It is clinically applicable. There are systems available. We just mentioned one. And, you know, everything's about earlier and earlier detection so we can intervene earlier with lifestyle. So I think that was a real important concept to bring up. And anybody that wants to go to the web and read about arterial stiffness, they'll find plenty. Now, I just threw out an example about 10 minutes ago, but somebody comes to your clinic in Gig Harbor. You know, my mother had a stroke at 68, my father had bypass at 52, and my brother just had a stent. I must be a walking time bomb. I mean, and they don't have any knowledge at that point of their cardiovascular health, but they're concerned and they should be in a clinic like yours. What's the process, and are they doomed to genetic, you know, jeopardy there?
No, I mean, you and I both know that they're, you know, genetics influence, they're an antecedent to what's going to take place for us, but it's the interaction between the genetics and the environment that makes such a difference. You know, there's that gene mutation of 9P21, which is one of the genes that codes for cardiovascular risk. And if you carry the risk allele, meaning you carry the mutation that puts you at risk for having increased heart disease, the risk goes completely away on a high vegetable diet. So at the end of the day, genetics can help us determine some risk or risk potential, but it's modifiable. It tells us where we do our work to make a difference. I mean, the first thing that takes place if you come to my office is a really detailed history. Where have you been? What's happened to you along the way? You know, what have you been doing? Basic questions like, were you a smoker at some point in time? Basic questions like, what's your diet like? Are you outside exercising? But deeper questions like, what's your profession been? What's your hobbies been? You know, you and I both know that, you know, toxic elements like arsenic, you know, particularly for diabetes, but like cadmium and lead for heart disease play a role. And, you know, if you never ask someone if they have a hobby, you're never going to hear that, you know, oh, they do stained glass work on the weekend and they're using a lead-based solder for the last 30 years. And, you know, surprise, surprise, or, you know, depending where your patient lives, you know, I had a patient who worked over in Tacoma and we worked on her blood pressure and we addressed, kind of body composition issues and we addressed diet and exercise and we still weren't getting her blood pressure anywhere that we really wanted it to. And it was just a couple of years after I had moved here to Gig Harbor and I suddenly realized that she worked really close to a Superfund site. The old Ruston refinery that had been there, which was originally a lead refinery and then a copper refinery, and all the toxicity that was associated with that. And at the time that it was a functioning refinery, they touted the fact that they had one of the biggest chimney stacks around for this sort of facility. All that really did was increase how far the plume went. Got it up a little higher, so it went on a bigger area, making Pierce County one of the 10, in the top 10% of dirty counties in the country from, you know, an environmental point of view. So getting a detailed history is the start, identifying what they've been doing, then doing things like getting accurate blood pressure numbers, you know, taking them at rest, taking them a couple times, having people monitor blood pressure at home so you really know where it is, not discounting white coat hypertension because I don't think either of us are particularly scary. And if someone's blood pressure is going up in the setting of seeing us, then it may be going up when they're commuting in traffic or the such like. And if it's the surges in blood pressure that lead to the damaged vessel wall when the vessel won't contract, and then it's doing things like doing an endopad or an EKG or, you know, just asking someone you know, about their exercise. If someone's exercising regularly and getting their heart rate up to target heart rates, they're kind of doing their home stress test each day on their own. And you get information just from that capacity. And then moving on to the labs and, you know, standard labs in my office, you know, yeah, we start with the, you know, basic chemistry. So we get a blood sugar, kidney function, liver function, but we go on to get the insulin. We get on to get the hemoglobin A1C. We get the advanced lipid panel. So we're looking at particle size and particle number as opposed to limiting our discussion to concentrations of the various lipids and acknowledging that, you know, we talk about good and bad cholesterol, but it's all the same cholesterol, right? It's all cholesterol. What's good or bad is the function of the carrier protein. Okay. HDL is good because it's reverse transport. LDL is bad, not because it doesn't do the necessary function of delivering, but because it's a lazy delivery guy at the end of the day who leaves its excess where it shouldn't. You know, looking at numbers like that, looking at homocysteine to get an idea about B vitamin metabolism and folic acid, looking at things like hsCRP to give us an idea about inflammation and cardiac risk, looking at a gamma glutamyl transferase as an add-on liver function test to give us some suggestion about, you know, persistent organic pollutant burden. There was a paper by Lim and Jacobs a number of years back that showed increased risk for progressing to type 2 diabetes, regardless of what your weight was, if you were in the top half of the normal range for a GGT. So it gives kind of an idea that, hey, we need to be working on things. And then after that basic kind of point, letting the history and letting the risk factors kind of drive us to what else do we do?
All right. And I think, I hope people listen to that once and people have an opportunity on a replay to listen again. That was an awesome list of advanced tests, but they're widely available. And it may be the first time we've talked about a simple blood test, GGT, gamma glutamyl transferase. Every lab, every clinic can offer it. And there's just so much information. It distresses me because it's a routine in my clinic too, when it's elevated and there's such an epidemic of fatty liver and toxicity and organic pollutants. So let's get to the fun part after we've learned so much about how you approach disease in your clinic, which is, let's just run through. I'll name a disease. You name me 3-4 of your top nutraceuticals, botanicals, supplements, vitamins. We can substitute the words we want to use. And you've got broad experience and you're, you know, advising a vitamin company. So let's start with high blood pressure. Doc, I check in my blood pressure just the way you told me, and I'm eating the DASH diet and I'm going to yoga, but my numbers still aren't optimal. I really don't want prescription drugs. And, you know, what's in your head? I mean, you know, what are you picking your top 3 or 4 choices?
Fish oil, DHA. So number one, probably, because so many people are imbalanced when it comes to their omega-3, omega-6. So, and if someone is vegetarian, we have algal sources of DHA, which are a great choice for them. Number two, magnesium. I think magnesium has to be my favorite mineral.
That's fine. Mine too. Mine too.
It's, I've seen, you've had this experience, seeing torsade, which is a version of ventricular tachycardia, go away with a simple infusion of magnesium. It really is very gratifying. So magnesium, and it has a great effect on blood pressure. And CoQ10 has an impact upon blood pressure. And, you know, all three things that I've mentioned so far have other impacts, right? they could be for supporting healthy function in other areas, not just the hypertension area. And then finally, a botanical, my first botanical would be hawthorn.
Interesting. Hawthorn berry.
Right.
Available typically in the capsules, sometimes in a combination with other agents. Often also.
It has mild beta blocker properties, and it has mild ACE inhibitor properties.
Interesting.
And I find it to be a really well-tolerated choice, just what we haven't talked about. But, you know, a lot of people have symptomatic premature ventricular contractions or a lot of, you know, premature atrial contractions. We call them palpitations. You know, we do, you know, a Zio patch or something like that, an event recorder. We're not so concerned anymore after we see a nice normal report or close to normal report, but they still have a lot of irregular beats and they're concerned, right? Because, you know, it doesn't feel good to feel your heart flip-flop. Hawthorne's a great choice in that setting.
And of course, there is the possibility they're in your clinic and they're 170 over 108. You might send them home with a couple or three of those in combination because they can be mixed and matched. CoQ, yeah. Magnesium, omega-3, and Hawthorne. There's no reason a person who needs it can't take all of them or two of them or three of them, some sort of therapy. Yeah.
And there, you know, at the end of the day, and maybe it's having started at this with an MD degree, and, you know, starting down the traditional medicine path, to me, you know, though we may be spiritual beings who've chosen to have a physical reality, we do have that physical reality. And both medications and botanicals and minerals, they all work because there's a target somewhere in a physiologic pathway that they hit. And if they're strong enough to work, they're potentially strong enough to have side effects too. So I don't really discriminate. If I saw someone 180 over 108, they would probably get a prescription ACE inhibitor as well as support with the others as they went out the door from the office.
All right, Dr. Lamb, we've had a couple visits. I've lost some weight. I've used the prolonged fasting mimicking diet, maybe. I'm eating the Mediterranean diet. I'm exercising more. But you're telling me my HOMA insulin resistance, my fasting blood sugars, my fasting insulin, I'm just not where we need to be, and I don't want drugs. Don't you have some botanicals, three or four nutraceuticals for me, for my blood sugar?
First one would be berberine. It's an AMPK agonist, has the same mechanism of action, actually, as metformin, but so it's going to directly address insulin resistance. So it makes the cells listen better to the insulin you produce. But the advantage is it has a lot less GI side effects than metformin does. And the other piece is it doesn't seem to be associated with weight gain. So I like berberine. We did a lot of work at Metagenics with a combination of hops and various other components. So it was the isoalpha acids and hops, RIAA and THIAA. And they were in some of our medical foods at one point in time. And the RIAA combination is with acacia, which is extract of the gum arabic tree. And that's actually in a product called Insinase. And the other one that I like is a product called Ostera, which, you know, it's labeled for bone health, but it's the RIAA and berberine. And, you know, I use it frequently. And it's kind of interesting because I have to always give the caveat, you know, as I'm giving it to a man, you're going to get the label and the label's going to tell you it's for postmenopausal women with osteoporosis, but these will work for you as well. Because, you know, osteoporosis is an inflammatory disease made worse by dysinsulinemia. So,
So that was good. Berberine. Now, some people's ears went up when you said hops. We're not talking about taking a six pack of beer and getting your hops in the traditional weekend football way. We're talking about, you know, targeted capsules, targeted powders. You mentioned a company, not everybody knows the name, Metagenics, which has done the research in humans, which you're affiliated with through the clinic, wonderful company. So people can search out more about hop support without us suggesting that you're supposed to be drinking a good IPA. Okay, and the final one, Dr. Lamb, I love what you're doing for me in the clinic. I feel better. But this last cholesterol panel, I'm still not happy with the LDL and the particles. You know, I've tried to do it with diet and exercise. What can you give me, a powder, a capsule, a liquid? I wanna stay away from prescription drugs for my cholesterol control.
The first distinction I make is, what does the advanced lipid panel look like? You know, I see a lot of people who have a slight elevation of their LDL, and overall their LDL particle number is increased, but they don't have a lot of the small dense particles. So in a case like that, I feel a little bit more comfortable taking a conservative approach for a while, and fish oil makes a big difference. You know, it doesn't necessarily reduce the concentration of your LDL cholesterol. So that number that we get on the report that says LDL-C may not change a lot with fish oil, but the LDL particle size increases and the particle number decreases as the concentration stays the same, and that's a favorable change. So I would say fish oil is a start there. Next piece is if the LDL particle number's high, well, concentration's high, the LDL particle number's high, and the small dense LDL particles are also elevated, then you start thinking about botanicals like red yeast rice or bergamot orange and those sorts of pieces. And they've been shown to make significant differences. And one of the tests, I'm sure you get this too, but one of the ones I really like looking at is the oxidized LDL, right? Because it's, when it comes right down to it, it is that small dense particle that creates a lot of the risk, but it's when it gets either glycated, which means gets a sugar molecule added onto it, which at the moment we can't test in a clinical setting, or oxidized, when a fat goes rancid, basically, like from oxidative stress, which is why we take all the antioxidants that we talk about taking. But when it becomes oxidized, that particle is particularly pro-inflammatory, and it kicks off the whole system. And so when I start looking at the oxidized LDL, I start thinking about things that have been shown in clinical studies to reduce it. And we did a study just on a multivitamin. Our phytomulti led to a 15% reduction in oxidized LDL levels in healthy individuals eating kind of the standard American diet. And at Nature Sunshine, we did a antioxidant combination, 9 botanicals, added to bergamot orange, and we showed, you know, about a 20% reduction in LDL and about in the mid-teens reduction in oxidized LDL. And then finally, if I'm getting a little bit more, chasing a little bit more of that whole process, and if I've seen endothelial dysfunction like on an endopath, and we have numbers that we don't like, and we have an hsCRP that's up, and we're thinking inflammation, I really start thinking about the hops compounds again. We had a paper in atherosclerosis a number of years back demonstrating that THIAA blocked the adhesion of monocytes to vascular endothelial cells. So the monocyte adhering to the vessel wall, migrating through the vessel, really, and becoming a macrophage, the macrophage being, it's trying to clean up the inflammation that's there, but gets locked into a cycle of kind of progressive inflammation. And the tetrahydroisoalpha acids, we showed in the study that we had in atherosclerosis, and we had a small study using tetrahydroisoalpha acids and niacin that we had in Global Advances in Health and Medicine that improved endothelial function in people with hypertension.
I don't think most people logged on expecting to hear the medicinal and health value of hops as much as you brought it up. But of course, for the many decades that Metagenics has been a leader in natural products, hops have been in, you know, many of the substances. So there's a lot of clinical successes. I thought that was fascinating. And right at the end, just the last question, you did say the word niacin. Is niacin in your armamentarium for cholesterol disorders as a, you know, over-the-counter version?
It is. You know, it's actually interesting because our marketing group, you know, I hate to say this, but they were slightly influenced by it. You know, we never had a THIAA niacin product because at the time that the R&D team pitched it, it was right after the AIM-HI study.
Right.
And the AIM-HI study, when you was thought by many to be kind of a death knell for the concept of using niacin to improve HDL and improve cardiovascular health in that regard. But the AIM-HI study should probably have been MIS-AIM and MIS instead of AIM-HI. You know, they were trying to isolate the impact on HDL. So they had a group of people who were on statin drugs and they added niacin to it. And niacin does have independent effects on LDL cholesterol. So if their LDL went down, they actually decreased the statin dose that they were on to maintain the LDL at approximately the same level. And, you know, that's implying to a certain extent that the only impact of a statin is on LDL and neglecting the impact on as an anti-inflammatory. So they didn't see evidence that raising HDL was going to reduce the risk for development of atherosclerosis, partly because of study design. And then they stopped the study early because they thought that the safety committee was seeing an increased number of strokes in the group who had been assigned to taking niacin. And one of the things that you need to realize about these big studies is when safety committees look at these pieces, people are enrolled in the study, they are continued to follow in the study, even if they discontinued what they were taking. So when they looked at this data later on, though people were in what's called the intent to treat group for niacin, the great majority of people who had had strokes, these hemorrhagic strokes, hadn't been on niacin within the last 3 to 6 months. So niacin was probably not associated with their increased risk for stroke. And it probably was random occurrence, but they stopped the study early because they hadn't looked at that data. So niacin remains a good choice, particularly if you've measured LP little a, which is another kind of advanced lipid marker, and it's looking at sort of a variant of LDL cholesterol. I like to think about LP little a, if LDL is the lazy cement truck driver who leaves you a present of cement in your drainage ditch because he doesn't want to take it back at the end of the day, LP little a is the angry cement truck driver who leaves the cement right in the middle of your driveway, or worse yet, right in your convertible. So it becomes important to treat that, and LP little a is refractory, and niacin's a great choice in that regard.
I think people have learned a ton and can take comfort that, as you said, and I agree, prescription medication pharmaceuticals are needed and can be beneficial, but in many circumstances, there may be the opportunity to combine and there may be the opportunity to slowly back off and maybe avoid altogether, always working with somebody experienced like you. So I want to thank you. Tell us, there are people listening to this that are on the West Coast and might want to travel and visit you in your clinic. How do they find you or your clinic, and how do they connect?
Easiest telephone number is 253-853-7233. If you want to know more about me and about the clinic, the website josephlammd.com tells you about what we've got going on.
Well, that's easy enough. josephlammd.com. Well, thank you, Doc, for taking time out. It's great to reconnect. Maybe I'll see you soon at a medical meeting as the world has reopened, and God bless for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Honored to be here today.